Welcome to the Faculty of Horror. We're podcasting from the continually sunny halls, but you know what? They're not halls anymore. We're actually in the great outdoors. You are at Camp Faculty of Horror. Hooray! It's great. We spent a lot of time indoors reading books. There are some essays we needed to write.
I made a dream catcher.
And we just felt, you know what, last episode we talked about the beach, we talked about going to the beach, the great American vacation, and this time we thought we'd talk about the great American child vacation, which is when your loving parents ship you off to camp, and that rite of passage, and it's a rite of passage to either go to camp or usually work at a camp. And you're very lucky because Andrea and I not only have our master's degrees where we talked about horror, but we were also both camp counselors. And, you know, we terrorize those children.
Yeah, it's true. I went to camp as a camper, as a kid. I had some friends in high school who were going to the same camp, so I thought, what the hell? And I went with them. And I guess we were preteens, so we were old enough to kind of appreciate. Canoeing was still kind of cool. You were still old enough to swim. I don't know. Maybe there was a couple of boys there or something. But you looked up to these counselors who were really way too young to be in charge. And then I became a counselor, and I had that exact same feeling repeated over again, where it's like, wait, I'm responsible for this many children. You're paying me this much, and you trained me next to nothing.
I actually had a really similar experience, and I remember my health section of the training was just shove an EpiPen in some kid's thigh if you need to. So thankfully, I never had to, or I don't think I had to. I think that kid was fine. I'm sure it's fine.
I didn't ever receive that training, but it's good to know that you have that in case I eat a peanut. So yeah, this episode is a bit of a blast from the past for us, and it turns out a lot of really seminal horror films have taken place on a campsite, which is what we're going to talk about today.
Summer camps or sleepaway camps, however you want to think of them, really originated, generally it's attributed to originating around 1861. And it was part of a school, and they kept the children on through the summer. And that summer, they would take them further out into the country. They would camp out. They would make fires. They would go hiking. They would tell stories. Basically, there was a real sense of, as industrialization was spreading, that there needed to be a semi-return to nature, just a little bit, to remind youngsters that, you know what, sometimes there are skills you can't learn in front of a coal mine or a car manufacturing company. And what's interesting is, so, you know, the one first camp that it's generally attributed to started in 1861, and then by 1900s, there were hundreds of camps. This was a phenomenon that took off very quickly, and people started to see a lot of value in it. And it actually continued to be very popular throughout the 20th century. There was a real sense that they could instill a morality, a purity in a lot of young kids. And even through the kind of horrors of the 20th century, like World War II and the Cold War, there was a sense of skill building while you were away. You know, you could learn to build a fire, you could learn to make shelter, you could learn how to make food easily. These were all things that they felt were really important and necessary to the development of a young person in the 20th century.
Camp Seagull for boys and Camp Seafarer for girls offer campers the experience of a lifetime. Through our 1, 2, and 4 week programs, campers build deep friendships, learn lots of skills on activities, build self-confidence, self-reliance, and go home better people.
Now, generally, these camps were kind of a mix of a military regiment and Native American culture. So you have the mess hall, the getting up at dawn, lineups, those kind of things, which were very military inspired. And then a lot of the cultural Native American traditions, which were really plagiarized by North American culture. So the sense of storytelling, the sense of history, some very insensitive craft making. There are a lot of things going on at this camp. But actually, starting in the 1980s, camps were on the decline. The baby boomer generation had grown up, the population was declining just a little bit, people were having less kids. So there was not a great demand for these kind of camps. But they were really just such a part of the American identity. They were as American as apple pie. So even though camps were declining in terms of enrollment and attendance, they were still a huge part of popular culture. And you start to see this in films. So We actually have this a little bit in Piranha, which we talked about in our last episode, where Paul's daughter is enrolled in a summer camp, but more so in the 1979 film Meatballs, which is actually a Canadian joint. It was directed by Ivan Reitman and starring Bill Murray, and that actually became a huge hit and really helped set that culture and the tone and the sense that, you know, while the adults are away, the kids will play.
I'm your head counselor. I'm
hoping to make your summer camp experience the best available in this price range.
For one summer, the parents of 300 children...
You must be the short, depressed kid that we ordered.
Come on inside, Frankenstein. I'll buy a cocktail.
...are putting their faith...
These are the camp rules.
Be in here if you want to check these out a little bit later.
...in one man.
There's no way we're going to beat this team.
What are we going to do?
We're going to lose. But we can lose with some self-respect.
It just doesn't matter! It just doesn't matter!
I gotta get out of
here! How's the leg?
Okay.
Yeah, for now. But if you don't win, we cut it off. But the real excitement, of course, is going to come at the end of the summer. During Sexual Awareness Week, we import 200 hookers from around the world, and each camper, armed with only a thermos of coffee and $2,000 cash, tries to visit as many countries as he can.
Oh, my God. Take me.
And then the winner, of course, is named King of Sexual Awareness Week.
Bill Murray. Meatballs. Really?
So the first film we wanted to talk about is 1980's Friday the 13th. Not the 2009 remake. We'll just deal with that on another show.
Hello? Who is that? Oh, hi. What are you doing out in this mess?
One.
We weren't doing anything. We were just messing up.
Four. Five. Six.
Must be my imagination.
Seven.
Can I help you? Hello?
Eight.
Now, this was made the year after John Carpenter's Halloween. As we've already talked about, Halloween was such a huge success that a lot of producers and a lot of people who were looking to make money and quick money wanted to jump on this. And the first person to do so in any meaningful way was Sean Cunningham, who oversaw what would become the Friday the 13th franchise. So while Halloween still was figuring out a lot of tropes, then some of them were very heavily borrowed from films like Black Christmas and Peeping Tom and Psycho, Friday the 13th helped cement them in a really contemporary culture. So we have elements that are present, like the terrible location, which in this case is the camp. We have a lot of killer point of view shots, and we have young adults left unsupervised. Friday the 13th starts in 1958, the year before a young boy Jason has tragically drowned while he was left unsupervised while he was swimming, and he's basically revealed to be kind of a mongoloid, for lack of a better term, and he tragically drowns. And then the next year, through a killer point of view shot, we see two camp counselors sneak away to get a little frisky with each other, and they are brutally murdered. The film picks up in present day, or, you know, 1979, 1980, with several groups of young people all heading to this same camp. It is about to be reopened, refurbished, and open for business once again. We have the counselors encounter some locals of this town who keep saying to them, "That's Camp Blood. Bad things happen there. Don't go there. For the love of God, don't go there."
"You're going to Camp Blood, ain't you?
God damn it, Ralph. Get out of here. Go on, get. Leave people alone.
You'll never come back again."
"Oh, shut up, Ralph.
It's got a death curse."
But of course they go there. They all start to have a fun time getting to know each other, hanging out, renovating parts of the camp, but they always feel this presence, something that is watching them, that is not too far off. Slowly, they start getting picked off one by one by one, until we are left with our final girl, Alice. She becomes more and more afraid the more friends she discovers dead. She runs out and runs straight into a woman named Mrs. Voorhees, who seems like the woman who will help get her to the cops. But lo and behold, if you didn't already know, spoiler alert, Mrs. Voorhees is the mother of the young boy who drowned Jason. She and Alice struggle. Alice subdues her, chops her head off, and Alice thinks that everything is done. She gets in a canoe, sets out into the lake, and dreamily sleeps there, until all of a sudden a young boy rises from the Camp Crystal Lake grounds and pulls her underneath. We find her waking up in a hospital room where she is told that everyone is basically dead, and when she asks about the young boy Jason, they tell her there is no such boy, and the only thing she can say is,
"Then he's still there."
And there you have the birth of one of the most enduring and popular horror franchises out there.
It's true. This movie was so huge. I've actually written out all of the sequels, and there are 10 of them, 12 if you include Freddy vs. Jason and then the remake in 2009, the one that we said we wouldn't talk about. But all these movies happened so quickly. Part 2 came out in 81, Part 3 came out in 82. None of these films came out more than, I don't know, 3 years of each other. It was a massive, massive franchise. There was also a TV show.
Louis Vendredi made a deal with the devil to sell cursed antiques, but he broke the pact, and it cost him his soul. Now his niece Mickey and her cousin Ryan have inherited the store, and with it, the curse. Now they must get everything back, and the real terror begins.
As I recall, it didn't actually have anything to do with the movies or Crystal Lake, anything. It was actually more of a, it reminded me of that movie Needful Things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There were people in an antique store, yeah. And every item kind of had its own story that would follow with it, which I loved. But it also spawned a Nintendo game that changed my life. And I know this podcast isn't about video games, but listeners, if anyone out there has been as obsessed with Friday the 13th on the original Nintendo Entertainment System as me, send me an email so we can nerd out about it. I've got strategies. I can survive the first two nights, but that third one always gets me, so I'd love to hear your tips. Part of the reason I think this franchise had such an enduring impact is because the formula, having already been laid out by Halloween, was just so easily replicated. The camp was just a perfect setting for innocent, nonstop teenagers who were having sex and doing things that would get you killed in a slasher movie, and it just kept happening.
And I don't know about you, Andrea, but I know when I went to camp, and I actually never went to a sleepaway camp because I was such a fucking nervous child. It freaked me out too much. But even on day camps, I would get worried because my parents weren't there and I didn't know what was going to happen. And there was a real sense of unease that I had kind of around this. So when I saw Friday the 13th, and actually Friday the 13th Part 2 scared me more when I saw it. And I saw these pretty early on, like probably when I was 11 or 12. They really freaked me out. I had like nightmares after seeing them.
Another interesting factoid about the significance of Friday the 13th, and this was actually referenced in Alex's favorite movie of all time, Scream, is that it's a continuing horror trivia nugget that it wasn't actually Jason Voorhees who committed the murders in the first film, but that it was his mother.
Name the killer in Friday the 13th.
Jason! Jason! Jason!
I'm sorry. That's the wrong answer.
No, it's not. No, it's not. It was Jason.
Afraid not? No way.
Listen, it was Jason. I saw that movie 20 goddamn times.
Then you should know Jason's mother, Mrs. Voorhees, was the original killer. Jason didn't show up until the sequel. I'm afraid that was a wrong answer.
Another interesting factoid is that the hockey mask that has become ubiquitous with Jason Voorhees and Friday the 13th didn't actually show up until part three.
And I think for any non-horror fans, if you choose to know these people, they may not know those two little factoids, but they understand who Jason with the hockey mask is. That's actually, you know what? Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about the remake, but that's what I found was really interesting about it, was they didn't trust the story enough, so they actually crammed the first three films into one film. So, you know, I think it was, oh God, I've only seen it once or twice. Like, by halfway through the film, Jason fucking picks up the hockey mask, and it's supposed to be this, like, bro cheering moment in the film, but it's you know, you need the buildup, you need the subtlety, you need the layers. But getting back to our original point, because we don't want to lead you campers astray and go up too off topic, what I really found going back to this film, and I've watched this movie so many times over the years, but what always strikes me, especially as I've gotten older, is how beautifully those grounds are shot, how idyllic it looks, how pure, how unadulterated. And there's a real loving gaze on, you know, the water and the grounds. And it's very interesting to think that through a young adult mistake, innocence was destroyed. And it starts with Jason dying in 1957, and then it only kind of perpetuates itself. It's almost like that one occurrence was a curse on this once pure land.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense that the land is cursed and that the place is cursed. And I think part of the reason the original remains so redeeming and the sequels kind of lose steam is that it did have a good mystery to it. I think people did suspect that maybe somehow child Jason survived, because with the knowledge that the sequels exist and that Jason is the hockey-masked killer, it's an easy mistake to make. But in the first film, it is quite a mystery and quite an exciting reveal.
Did you know that a young boy drowned the year before those two others were killed? The counselors weren't paying any attention. They were making love while that young boy drowned. His name was Jason.
I think one of the first instances we get in Friday the 13th of something being really wrong or not quite right in the present day is when Alice is in her cabin and she's getting changed, I think, from a shower, and a snake goes across her floor and she screams and the other counselors run in to see if they can help. One of the male counselors, it might have been Kevin Bacon, actually cuts off the snake's head. And of course, snakes are hugely representative of evil, especially in our, you know, Christian culture. So the fact that they cut off the head of it was a sense that there's something not quite right. And that scene, I always wondered, you know, and I still kind of debate whether it should be included in the movie, but then when you watch the ending and Alice decapitates Mrs. Voorhees with the canoe paddle, it's actually kind of a nice foreshadowing of what's going to happen. Now, the Friday 13th franchise, you might not really see it as, you know, having foreshadowing or taking heed of literary tropes, but it actually does. There's a literary trope called pathetic fallacy, and the long and the short of it is when nature reflects a strong human emotion or human turmoil. One of the most iconic uses of this is in Shakespeare's play King Lear. As Lear goes mad, the storm rages around him, creating a really dynamic and dramatic scene. Now, as we see in Friday the 13th, as, you know, the kills start to escalate, the storm moves in. And so as Alice and the final counselor start running around trying to find everyone, it's pouring down rain and it's harder to move around. It's harder to get outside. The visibility is gone. It's a very scary place to be as you start losing it. And it also feeds into the fact that Jason, or in this case, Mrs. Voorhees, that anger, that rage, that loss, it's a part of God. It's the will of God, as we've talked about many times in this podcast, being sent to right a wrong. It is the natural order trying to restore something that was wronged a long time ago.
And as Alex mentioned when she was describing the emergence of the camps were essentially created to represent a return to nature. And so I found the shot with the snake was just implying that this return to nature does have its risks. It's glamorized in terms of you get more in touch with the earth and with nature and this and that. But threats do exist. And there are snakes, there are predators, and there's also the lake. And insofar as Jason's drowning was the result of negligence, these things can and do happen.
And one of the things I've found in the past few years when I've watched Friday the 13th is I'm always struck by how responsible these young group of counselors actually are. They seem to be pretty with it. When their friend Ned, who's a total asshole in this scene, pretends to drown, you see those camp counselors mobilize and like one gets in a canoe, you know, the others dive in the lake and try to find him. They're really on top of it. They're really trying to save their friend. So there is a sense that even though these kids might actually be okay and they might be really responsible, there is still an imbalance that needs to be corrected. Another big proponent of the slasher genre, especially the emerging slasher genre, is the harbinger of doom, or just the sense of doom. And I think any great slasher or horror trope, if they did it well in Cabin in the Woods, it's a pretty iconic trope.
Fucking zombie arm!
Now, the sense of doom is conveyed in a couple ways. Obviously, you have the town history, you have the line cook, the chef who's about to go up there. She doesn't even make it to the camp. She gets killed before she even gets there. And, you know, Ralph tells them that they're all going to die. It's all going to be awful, and you just shouldn't go up there and leave well enough alone. Now, the tragedy of those people is that they aren't to be believed. That is their doom. That is, you know, their fate. They aren't to be believed because, as we will see throughout the franchise, no one heeds this warning. They keep going up there. They keep trying to make money and open this camp, and it never works out. Now, the other sense of doom that really permeates this film is told filmically. So it's the killer's point of view shot. And we as an audience are privileged to that. We understand that there is something watching them, that there is something after them that is tracking these young kids. And because they're good performances and, you know, likable enough people, we're worried for them. But they also refuse to heed that warning. They see themselves as better, as new world, and they don't believe in that stuff. And again, this is something we've talked about on this podcast, where if you don't heed the warnings of the old world, you will succumb to them.
Quit. Quit now.
Quit? Why would I want to quit?
Camp Crystal Lake has changed.
That kind of mentality was especially relevant in the early 80s when we've got New Right Reaganism, anti-abortion, AIDS is getting blamed on deviant sex, be it promiscuous sex or gay sex. And in this respect, I really felt like Friday the 13th conflated this return to nature with the return to normality. It's shocking at the end to think that this all-American, sweet old lady is the killer, but what she's actually doing is protecting the nuclear family. She's protecting the family unit and the values that have been lost and seeking revenge on these kids about it.
You let him drown. You never paid any attention. Look what you did to him. Look what you did to him.
Attacking the younger generation for their sexual freedom, which resulted in the breakdown of her family, quite literally in the death of Jason, but also in the wider American context. And so building off that point, that takes us to the second film that we want to talk about, Robert Hiltzig's 1983 film Sleepaway Camp.
Dear Mom and Dad, I've been at a sleepaway camp for almost 3 weeks, and I'm getting very scared.
Welcome to Sleepaway Camp. Someone is watching you.
Hey, Baba, revolve!
Someone is waiting for you. Someone wants to scare you to death.
Turn it! Turn the wheel!
Oh my God!
Sleepaway Camp. you won't be coming home.
Now, if you're listening to this episode, you've clearly seen the description. You know we're going to talk about this film. We already gave a huge spoiler away for Friday the 13th, but not as many people have maybe seen Sleepaway Camp and the ending. We're going to have to talk about the ending, and it's the spoiler of all spoilers. So I'm telling you right now, if you have not seen the film, turn this audio off. It is the only time I'm going to tell you not to listen to our podcast. But I am going to tell you to watch this film right away because it's actually pretty awesome. The first time I saw it, I was a teenager, I guess. I was an undergrad, and it was something I watched really late with a girlfriend of mine. And I am not the hugest slasher fan. You might have heard me say this back in the Halloween episode. I'm not terribly keen on them. I'm especially not keen on them when there is no mystery, when you know who the killer is, and it's just formulaic stalking and disposing of disposable teens. It's not really my thing, but Sleepaway Camp is really something special.
I actually had this movie spoiled for me on the playground when I was in, like, middle school, of all things. I vividly remember this. And I'd been watching horror movies, and I think that's why this girl told me, because she was also kind of secretly into horror films. So she told me this, and, you know, this was in before the spoiler alert era, so she just was, like, excited and just told me. And I was like, well, that sounds weird. And I didn't see it for a long time. I feel like I probably saw it either much later in high school or maybe, like you, Andrea, early university. And it was so much more bananas than I could ever have imagined. If you're really keen on Sleepaway Camp, I highly recommend you go check out another podcast called How Did This Get Made and listen to their whole episode on Sleepaway Camp. It's a comedy podcast, and they basically just try to figure out how the whole movie makes sense. It's really funny. It's not analysis, but it's really fun, and I highly recommend that. They actually brought up a point, because they're all working comedians in LA, that they talked to the creators of Wet Hot American Summer, and they discovered that that film, which is a really popular David Wayne film, was very deeply inspired by Sleepaway Camp and the style and the weird sense of humor that goes throughout the whole film.
It is so weird. This movie is really, really off the wall. And Alex actually sent me a clip of that podcast that she just mentioned. And these folks had the hardest time figuring out the familial links between the characters. And I watched it and I was like, God, was it really this complicated and convoluted? And then I watched it again to record this. And it's really not. So I'm going to lay it out to you straight. And maybe we can send this podcast to their podcast and they can get their shit straight.
Okay, let's just break this down without... Okay, this is my understanding of the movie, okay?
Yes.
Father and son and daughter are in the sailboat.
Yes.
Father's lover, a man, is on the shore.
Yes.
He's saying, hurry back to shore, your wife is coming, the doctor.
That's where you're wrong.
Really?
Right there is where you're wrong.
So the film starts out with John Baker, who is out on the lake with his kids, Angela and Peter, young boy and girl who are, I don't know, they look like they're about 5 or 6, let's say. Now they're hanging out in the water, having a good time, when all of a sudden a boat accident kills John Baker and one of the children. Now the surviving child, who we know to be Angela, the little girl, goes to live with John Baker's sister, Dr. Martha Thomas. And Martha has a child of her own, Angela's cousin named Ricky. Now, Martha Thomas is absolutely terrifying. She is probably the first thing you see in the film that gives you that epic uppercase what the fuck moment.
Hurry, sweeties! We don't want to be late for the bus!
Goodness, no. That wouldn't do at all.
Anyway, she's super, super bizarre. She has these shades of dissociative disorder that come out within her. She's obsessed with being the perfect mom and having the perfect cookie-cutter family.
Did you do a minor in psych?
Well, you see that she asks herself questions and then answers them?
Here they are, all filled out and signed by yours truly. Wasn't that nice of me?
What are they?
Why, they're your physicals, of course. We can't go to camp without our physicals now, can we?
Just be careful not to tell anyone how you got them.
Oh, no, no, I'm afraid that they wouldn't approve of that at all. Even though they know that I am a doctor.
So Angela and Ricky live with Martha, and Martha is sending them off to sleepaway camp. Now, Angela is very, very, very quiet. And I've read different reviews of this movie who say that she's just really introverted. She's not introverted. There is something seriously wrong with her. I guess it's not that hard to believe considering the trauma that she witnessed and some more trauma that we're going to talk about. But she's pretty fucked up, and Ricky is kind of looking out for her. So they get to the camp, and that's where they meet Paul. Paul is a friend of Ricky's from last year, and Paul kind of takes a shine to Angela. We also meet Judy, who is the talk of the camp, because apparently she developed breasts over the winter.
And she has a t-shirt with Judy on it.
Just in case you were looking at the wrong place on her, I guess. Angela is put into the same group as Judy, and Meg is their counselor. And Meg is really, really mean. And it isn't long before Meg and Judy start picking on Angela for being so introverted.
Well, say something, you spoiled little bitch!
What's the problem?
My good friend, Angela here, doesn't feel like going in the water today.
Oh, she doesn't, does she?
Well, I think I can fix that.
So as the summer goes on, we see a lot of playful conflict between Ricky and his friends and the older boys. There's definitely a big divide between the older boys and the younger boys. They play sports against each other, they place bets against each other, and they try to get each other in trouble with Mel, the camp owner, basically. The girls are kind of up to the same tricks, but every so often they have these socials at the canteen, which is almost like these little kids are hanging out at a bar. And it is in this context that Ricky's friend Paul befriends Angela, gets her to come out of her shell a little bit, and the two become something of an item, insofar as, I don't know, 11-year-olds could be.
Those are some sexualized 11-year-olds.
They really are. In fact, the whole movie, all of these kids are hyper, hyper sexualized. And one of the things about Sleepaway Camp that sets it apart from other slashers are that the victims are actually quite young children. It's not the counselors the way it was in Friday the 13th. And it's not like Piranha, where maybe there was a handful. The carnage is dished out among pretty small kids. Anyway, throughout the summer, Angela is getting bullied and tormented. And eventually, people who bully and torment her start dying one by one. And toward the end, the campground's owner, Mel, gets wise to the fact that these conflicts are resulting in murders. So he actually suspects Ricky and at one point attacks him and beats him up like an ape in Planet of the Apes.
Fuck off of me! Leave me alone!
Like you left out of your belly! Just like you left me!
What the fuck you're talking about? I didn't do nothing. Stop it. I didn't do anything, you crazy fuck. Stop it. I didn't do nothing.
In addition to the bullying, Angela also finds Paul making out with Judy.
I would also say there's a really important scene which starts setting off the tone of when they get to sleepaway camp, which is when Angela is almost sexually assaulted by the head chef or the head cook. And it's a really disturbing scene, mainly because we see him referring to all the campers as baldies, which, ugh. Andrea and I are both making faces at this one because it's so hideously disgusting. But, you know, there is that kind of hypersexualization and the punishment that can go along with that.
Hey, look at all that young, fresh chicken. Where I come from, we call them baldies. Makes your mouth water, don't it?
Marty, they're too young to even understand what's on your mind.
Then, good buddy, there ain't no such thing as being too young. You're just too old.
So in addition to all this happening, there's also, as Angela and Paul's relationship develops, Paul tries to take it a step further, and Angela has these horrible flashbacks where she sees her father in bed with another man, and she and her brother are sitting in the doorway just giggling away. And then the flashback goes into the two of them sitting across from each other in a bed with Peter holding out his finger at Angela, and they're sitting in a bed, and the scene to me communicates that they're playing doctor and that they were applying what they saw with their father to each other, and this was kind of an early sexual education that traumatized her. Did you get that sense? It's a really ambiguous scene.
I would agree with that assessment. Like you said, there's so much ambiguity in that scene that it's kind of how you read it. But when Paul really starts being a bit more sexually adventurous with Angela. He's on top of her and he's making out with her, and they're children. They're like little baby children. Well, not baby. They're like preteens. And Angela's like staring off, not letting Paul do whatever, and she's staring off blankly. And it's a really uncomfortable scene to watch. And then she flashes back to that. And I think there's a sense that this child does not understand sexuality. It was, you know, a bit too much too soon.
So when Angela rebuffs his advances, Judy starts getting on to him. Judy is jealous that Angela's getting all this attention away from her boobs. And so Judy convinces Paul to go off with her, and the two of them make out, and Angela stumbles upon them, which puts them right in harm's way. And of course, they both wind up getting killed. Now, in the penultimate scene, Paul is apologizing profusely to Angela and wanting to make it up to her. And she agrees to meet him on the waterfront after the social. By this time, the camp is aware of all the murders and is in a state of crisis, and two camp counselors go to collect Angela and Paul, and they find Angela naked on the beach, cradling Paul's head while humming. And as they stare aghast, Angela stands up, turns around, and what?
Penis. It's a penis.
Yes, she has a penis. We see from her naked body that she is actually, in fact, a boy. And then another brief flashback sequence shows us that her aunt Martha, who adopted her, so wanted a little girl to flesh out her perfect nuclear family that, in fact, it was Peter who survived the accident, and she just dressed him up like a little girl and called him Angela.
Yes, I've always dreamed of a little girl just like you. I mean, we already have a boy, so another one simply would not do. Oh, no, absolutely not. A little girl would be so much nicer, don't you think so, Angela?
One of the things I found going back to Sleepaway Camp, this is another film I've gone back to time and again in my horror career because it's so strange and I kind of don't believe it's as strange as it is. And then I'm like, no, it really, really is. There are a lot of tight shorts in this film. But the reason I think it's so rewatchable is because the mystery of the film is, again, like Friday the 13th, it's who is the killer? Who is perpetrating all of these things? Now, the victims of the kills are all people who have wronged Angela in some way, and we see that Angela and Ricky have a really good relationship, a really kind relationship, so it would make sense that it would be one of those two. And then in the last moments of the film, we're all pretty certain it's Angela. So for me, the big reveal, and perhaps this is because it was spoiled for me when I was 11 or 12, is not who the killer is. It's the gender of the killer. It's the penis at the end. It's the penis at the end of the rainbow of the film. That's what is the real shocking thing and the shocking image of it. And that's what people will talk about time and again. And I think if you didn't have that ending, this film would just be kind of part of the annals of 80s slashers. It wouldn't be this, you know, iconic cult classic.
Absolutely, I have to agree. And in addition, obviously, the penis is the most shocking part of that ending scene, partly because we think it's a girl, but also partly because this is full frontal male. We don't see a lot of penises in horror that's not of the softcore variety.
Even Buffalo Bill tucked it in.
But in addition to the penis, she's making this face. She's got her mouth open wide and her eyes are wild, and she's making this crazy hiss that is actually quite animalistic and terrifying.
And what's interesting about that final scene, because it is, it's this bizarre facial expression from Angela. And I don't know if you know this, but what they actually did was they got, I think it was like an 18-year-old local boy, got him drunk and got him naked on screen and just stuck an Angela prosthetic mask on him, a mask of the actress Felicia Rose on him. And they just did that take, I think, probably once or twice. And but God, can you imagine being a drunk 18-year-old with a girl's mask on your face holding a head? It's weird. That'd fuck you up.
And having that become one of the most iconic images in horror film history, for sure. There's obviously a lot of heavy gender politics going on here that we'll get into. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about race relations, which really become apparent in the kitchen staff of this scene. The staff is predominantly black or some visible ethnic minority, and they're all silent, except for the head cook, Artie, who, as we already mentioned, was a really overt pedophile. And there's even an indication that Mel, the campground's owner, knows that Artie is really inappropriate and chooses to look the other way, which I thought was really telling.
part of the big problem of Camp Arawak, the camp where they're all at, is that Mel is constantly trying to cover it up. He is trying to protect his little empire. So as the bodies start piling up, he keeps being able to explain them away and explain them away. And it's a very unsettling thing. It's kind of like he came from the business school from either Jaws or Piranha.
And went on from the film to become mayor of something. So in addition to that, the gender stereotypes in this film are so incredibly over the top. And I was thinking about it while I was watching it, and I was thinking about what gender is. And as a sociologist, I am of the opinion that gender is completely socially constructed, and it's something that we're socialized into, and it's something that you're either comfortable in or later in life, and thank God, in this day and age, you can actually choose to belong to a different gender assignment should you decide that that's where you want to be. But in this film, it kind of really reminded me how, insofar as gender is socialized, high schools and to an even greater extent, camps are the sites where these things occur. This is the education that you got at camp, is how to be an adult. You're looking up to the big kids and you want to be like them.
And the big kids aren't even that big. They're still kids themselves in a lot of ways.
It's true. So there are so many things that highlight and polarize a gender divide. There's the focus on Judy with her newly developed boobs and the fact that she's suddenly into older boys.
Who are those guys?
Just some boys I met today.
Weren't they a little old for you?
Don't you know girls mature before boys?
That's bullshit and you know it.
Ricky, I don't have time for your nonsense right now.
There's when they're all sitting in the dinner hall, there's a lot of those camp songs where like the girls sing a part and then the boys sing a part and the girls aren't allowed to sing the boys' part because that's not the girls' part. Like these little things, these are cues that this is where you belong and it's a boundary that you don't cross.
Quiet, please. Decades long night. Thanks for nothing.
Now, Angela gets punished by Meg and Judy, as well as the boys, for not conforming to typical stereotypes of a young girl. And I also thought there was a lot of interesting gender politics in the characters of Judy and Meg. We've got Judy, who goes after Paul because he likes Angela. And then Meg, who wants to assert her dominance by trying to hook up with Mel. So these are kind of establishing a female hierarchy by displaying their feminine power, and it's always tied up with sex, which is, it's not something we don't know, but it's not something we tend to think about in movies about kids at camp.
Well, and I still think one of the most bizarre and perhaps upsetting kills I've ever seen in any horror film is Judy's death, where, as I understand it, and I think it's kind of commonly accepted, is that she gets a hot curling iron up the cooch, and that wouldn't kill you, but apparently it kills Judy because that's where all her power comes from. That's what I would think. But it's interesting that you use such a female object, a hair curler, which, you know, I think Andrea and I both use when we're feeling fancy, and it's used as a phallic symbol against you. It's a very traumatizing thing, is the thing you use to try to make you a woman is also the thing that basically rapes you to death.
That's right. It's a really, really upsetting scene. It's interesting that all of the kills in this film are very overt, except for that one, where we kind of see the brandishing of the weapon in a silhouette, and then we just hear the screams.
But for, you know, long-term fans of Sleepaway Camp, you might be happy to know that the actress who plays Judy actually made a short film, which is on the official Sleepaway Camp website. I didn't actually get a chance to watch it. I was a little busy today, but it is a short film about what Judy is doing now, and apparently she actually survived and just has a slightly singed cooch.
Extra curly pubic hair.
No!
So we have to talk about the ending, and we have to talk about why the ending is shocking. It's no doubt that it's shocking. It's burned its image into the minds of many a horror fan. And I think there's a lot of layers to the shock that you can get from this film. Now, I believe that the film wasn't made to be subversive or satirical or anything like that. I think it was made with some pretty deadpan right-wing conservative ideology, but watching it now, everything is so overt and over the top that it parodies itself. And I actually, last time I saw this film screened with a projector, like proper, was at a film screening series here in Toronto called Queer Fear, which was programmed by Joshua Dare, who has sadly moved to Newfoundland, and so nobody's doing it anymore, and I'm really choked about that. And it was an excellent selection because throughout we were just roaring, cracking up. It should be especially offensive to the LGBTQ community because it was so gendered and so rigid and over the top, but actually it's really fun to take a satirical look at it.
And I think that's actually where a lot of the horror in this film comes from. It's, you know, as Andrea was leading in with this segment, the notion of Reaganism and that trying to attain an ideal. I mean, obviously, Martha is trying to be the perfect mother, and she tried to be the perfect wife, but as she mentions, her husband leaves her, and she's very well kempt, and she speaks in a sing-songy voice. It's like the most fucked up version of Snow White you could imagine. And that leads her down this demented path where her psyche collapses in on itself like a dying star and leads her to do these things that she sees fit to have a nuclear family. And Peter is, you know, seems to be so traumatized. And we see this in the scene where Meg and Judy try to throw him, her in the lake, that, you know, this kid is still so traumatized by the death of his father and his sister that he can't comprehend anything. And so he just is trying to get by and trying to be. And it's interesting, I think, some of the commentary that Andrew was just talking about, but the notion that Angela is very quiet, this comes up again and again and again, and this seems to be one of the reasons why people hate her. But as a woman, that's kind of what you're taught to be. And if you're outspoken or if you have opinions, it's not necessarily that it's bad in this day and age, but it's commented on. And to kind of fit in and go along with the status quo, it's better to be quiet and observant and just sit back a little bit. And you have Angela just, you know, this kind of insightful rage that she evokes in people just through being quiet. There's something not right. There's definite imbalance happening in a different way than it happens in Friday the 13th, but still happening in this film.
And we also see that Angela does have the capacity to open up and be kind of normal if she's treated with some semblance of kindness or respect. She's able to talk to Paul eventually, and she also speaks to the female counselor who's nice to her.
Are you sure you don't want to play?
I'm sure.
Is there anything you would like to do? Go sailing or something?
That's okay. I don't mind watching.
So this all begs the question, why did Angela kill? You come to the end of the movie and, okay, we see a penis. How does her being biologically male explain the murder?
Penis.
Penis. Penis equals kill. I think what the film is trying to imply is that this confusion, the confusion on Peter slash Angela's part, just drove her to this extreme reaction that culminated in murder, that forcing Peter to dress and behave as Angela was so harmful and so traumatizing that this was an appropriate reaction. And yet now, looking back on it, now that we know that dressing like another gender is not really the worst thing that can happen to you, it's obviously very unfortunate that this was done against Peter's will. And I read a couple of articles leading up to this episode where they were very careful to distinguish that this was not transvestitism. This was forced cross-dressing because it was done without Peter's consent.
That's actually what separates this film from some films, which it occasionally gets lumped in with, like Psycho or Silence of the Lambs. While Norman Bates and Buffalo Bill may not have been true transsexuals, there was a choice involved, and Peter slash Angela just did not have a choice. So I think it's wrong to label this film as, you know, having a transsexual killer. I think that's flat out false.
I agree with that, but because it does tackle these issues, it has become a really prominent film in queer horror analysis, and rightfully so. My reading of the big reveal is actually that it was a reaction more out of anger, and maybe I'm going out on a limb with this, but you can tell me. I can only imagine that being born male and then being thrust into the role of a female and then being stuck into camp where nonconformity to female gender roles is so harshly punished. I really think that that was just it. That he was born into privilege that he didn't get to enjoy. Instead, he gets all this shit.
part of the joy of recording this podcast is that Andrea and I get to have a little back and forth before we start recording. And when Andrea told me this and was talking about the male ego being inflicted with feminine assault of the bullying and the teasing, I thought that was so interesting. And, you know, I think that's something we all still struggle with. And it's something that even in our much more progressive day and age, and hopefully we'll only continue to get more progressive, that there is this sense of fighting back. Even the most sensitive guys I know and the most thoughtful guys I know still struggle with their identity and still struggle with feeling, is it okay to feel like this if I don't do that? And, you know, am I man enough? And when should I be a man? The same as it is for women. So we're still kind of grappling with, hopefully for you and hopefully for us, not as many gender issues, but they're still so present. And I think what really speaks to a lot of people and a lot of outsider culture in this film is that it goes to such an extreme. And it goes to such an extreme that it's actually very funny. And then it's actually very serious and very affecting in some instances.
So returning to the themes that we were talking about in Friday the 13th, we talked about how the journey to a camp was like a return to nature, and we talked about how it was actually kind of a return to normalcy that was personified in Jason's mother trying to teach the younger generation a lesson or two about how to live their lives. In Sleepaway Camp, I feel like it's still present to a degree. We've got this camp that is otherwise perfect. There's some ugliness underneath the surface, but it's running business as usual, just the way America is. And in Sleepaway Camp, the disruption was manifested in the disruption to gender roles, which was just as hot a topic when the film was made in 1983.
A lot of slasher and horror film analysis has to do with the abject, and the abject is something that shows no respect for borders, position, or roles. And this goes, I think, really perfectly into the setting of a summer camp where you have two villains or murderers actually reverting back to a more pure state because they have been disrupted. You have Mrs. Voorhees, who is a mother without a child, and then you have Angela slash Peter, who is a boy trapped in a girl's body for a large portion of his life. And that confusion and that forcefulness to live these roles and live kind of by society standards tends to fall away when they are away from society and away from social norms. They are enabled to act out as such. They are enabled to act out on their purest fantasies and desires, whatever they may be and however twisted they may be in the end and how harmful they may be.
So we're eager to hear your interpretations of the ending. There is an endless stream of analyses on this film and of Friday the 13th, which we will, as usual, post in the blog post on the website. But yeah, we'd really like to hear from you. Did you go to camp? Did you have any strange experiences?
Did you have to wear a wig? And just the same as last year, Andrea and I are going on sabbatical. We're going to take a little bit of time off. We will be back in September. We are not leaving you. We are just taking a little bit of time off. We will be back with a brand new episode of The Faculty of Horror, probably middle to end of September. And we're just taking August off to work on a couple of our own projects, which hopefully we'll be able to talk about soon. But if you are in Toronto and you're listening to us, you probably want to attend the Festival of Fear at Fan Expo. And if you're not already planning on it and you're in Toronto, you definitely should, because the lovely Andrea Subisati is going to be taking part of several panels, either as a moderator or a guest. So if you want to get more, you should definitely come out, and I'll probably be hanging around as well. So if you're around and you're at Fan Expo, come find us. We might be around the Rue Morgue booth, and come say hi.
Thank you kindly, Alex. So in proper school form, we will see you in September. But for now,
office hours are closed.
Let's get